Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking COVID indoor dining, the way things have been handled, and maybe the way things hopefully can be handled or could be handled. As always, I'm joined by my co-host Martin. It was so funny. I didn't realize earlier today we had a podcast with Owen O'Brien, and I genuinely didn't realize it was our 600th episode. Did you even have it?
600 times I've had to discuss things with you. You've no idea the toll that takes on a man.
I, folks, if you saw him 600 episodes ago, he had long shoulder length hair. He was 6'2". He's now 5'2" and totally bald. And
it wears me down, Tony.
It does. Anyway, it's something to be marked. And I'm actually almost disappointed we missed it, but it just shows the level of work that goes in when you're putting it out at that rate that you don't even realize that's what we've done. Anyway, can we come back to the topic, because we are delighted to be joined by regular on the podcast, Professor Anthony Staines, who is also Professor Anthony Staines from DCU, but also for the purpose of this conversation, one of the leading members of ISAG, which is the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group. Anthony, how are you keeping? It's been a few weeks.
I'm grand. Happy 601st anniversary.
Yeah,
thank you
so much. But Anthony, look, it has been a few weeks, and we were the last time we were talking, I think I remember making the comment to you that you're, look, there doesn't matter what you say now in terms of zero COVID, they've put all their eggs in the vaccination basket, mm-hmm. No one's going to listen to you anymore. How do you feel that? For A, was I wrong? And B, has things moved on since then?
I think you're right in outline. I mean, the major focus is on vaccination. I think we're going to see some of the challenges they've seen in Israel, where the vaccination program is excellent. I mean, ours is good, but theirs is excellent. But they're still having serious problems with COVID, particularly in younger people. And we're going to see some of the problems they have in the UK, where vaccination's a little better than ours, but case numbers have been very high. Now, over the last couple of days, case numbers in the UK are falling, but we don't really know what's going to happen here yet. There's certainly grounds for some concern about COVID-19, particularly in younger people, if there aren't that many younger people vaccinated. And we don't know how effective vaccination is going to be as a control measure on its own. We do know that it is really helpful. It reduces your risk, but it may not be enough on its own to stop major outbreaks, which is what we want to do. The figures for older people are pretty clear. About 1 in 10 people who get COVID get significant long-term effects at 6 or 9 months after diagnosis. For children and adolescents, the figures are not as clear. But what's coming out seems to be that the maybe 7%, maybe 8%, so not quite as many, have long-term side effects. And the problem we face is we don't know what those side effects are. Very few children end up in hospital with COVID. Some do, but most do not. Very, very seldom does a child or an adolescent die of COVID. But the long COVID is a significant problem. What we would say to everyone is get vaccinated as fast as you can. And as vaccination opens up for teenagers, encourage your kids to get vaccinated too.
I was looking at a study there only in the last couple of days where they looked, I think it was 8,000 people who'd had COVID, and they were looking at the effects of long COVID, and there's cognitive problems, quite significant cognitive problems, 6-8 months down the line, that may be permanent. I mean, that has to be a worry for people.
It is a worry. I mean, we're hoping that they're not permanent, but we plain don't know. This is a virus we know a lot more about than we did a year ago, but there's still so much we don't know. And that's one of the things we don't know. It's not uncommon after any serious illness to have significant ill health for a period of time. But in many cases, that gets better. And we're hoping that's what happens with COVID, but we don't know. It looks like some of the damage that COVID does in adults is not fixable. So some of the damage to the heart, some of the damage to the lungs seems not to be fixable. We don't know about damage to the brain, and we're not going to know for a couple of years. And we're just stuck with that. That's uncertainty we can't avoid. The sensible strategy is to say, right, this may be really bad for you in the longer run. Let's stop it. What we have not done in this country is put the effort into stopping it. So we've allowed case numbers to rise sharply. We've said, you know, we won't flood the hospitals, and we probably won't. I mean, the Irish hospitals will probably will cope with whatever this next wave throws at them. And then that's fine. Everything's grand. We can just go ahead. There are worrying signs from the United States, but not so far from England, that the Delta variant affects young people more severely than previous variants. And people are in intensive care facilities in the United States, but not in England, are reporting a lot more cases. That may be something to do with specific features of the US population. We just don't know. But, you know, we can take some comfort in saying it doesn't seem to have happened to anything like the same extent in the United Kingdom, but probably more like them than we are like United States.
But Anthony, like I watched the video back of the CPAC conference in the US, where a crowd of the Donald Trump was the guest speaker as usual, and they were talking about what they were doing, and they gave a rapturous applause to the idea that they didn't make their that they didn't achieve the vaccine target. We don't have as much sort of vaccine hesitancy in Ireland. It certainly doesn't seem, the numbers don't bear it out. There are people queuing up to get vaccines. Pharmacies have done a phenomenal job, and I think it's underappreciated how well they've done in the few weeks that they've been doing the job. And obviously, the centres that are open are like, you know, 62,000 people being vaccinated on a day in a country, you know, very relatively small and sparsely populated country. We always forget that. In terms of, though, the vaccines having to beat the Delta variant, you know, this thing of Delta versus vaccine thing, it still means that, and I'm going to use an awful phrase, but it's nonetheless, it's almost an insurance phrase. Collateral damage in this. There are people who are actually suffering long term, and we speak to them. Martin, we've spoke to people in the long COVID network and the damage it's doing. And I know this is anecdotal. So again, correct me and tell me I'm wrong. But I also know of people who haven't known that they've had underlying health conditions and had COVID, and then this condition was exacerbated afterwards because they've been left in a sort of immunocompromised position. These are great concerns to people, surely, at this stage, when we think, sure, the idea is get as many vaccinated and the rest of the people just get the virus. We'll go from there.
Yeah. But if you go back to the beginning of this, WHO said that what we needed to do was to control the spread of the virus, bring the case numbers down, and keep them down and wait for vaccination. And vaccination has come along faster than anyone could reasonably have expected, which is great. And the vaccines we have work really well, which was not in any way guaranteed, but it has happened, which is fantastic. But we haven't got the third part of that right. We haven't kept the case numbers right down. And every time the case numbers peak up, there will be a price to be paid. So a small number of people with a vaccinated population, which is what we have now, a small number of people will die. A somewhat larger number will become seriously unwell. And it looks like around 10%, give or take, will have long-term health effects. And that's just the virus.
You know what's happening now? I'm about to interrupt the podcast because we need to ask you to put your hands in your pockets. If you're listening to this, if you enjoy the various podcasts across the network, be it the Two Norries, be it Policed, be it Glow West, which has had 82 episodes consecutive, unbelievable stuff put out by Caroline.
Do you know how many episodes we did today, Tony? Where were we at?
601.
I can't believe 601. It just flew by, really.
It did. I recall, Martin, at the beginning of lockdown, we weren't sure where we were going, if you remember. I was driving around.
No, we didn't know. I didn't know, Tony.
Driving around with USB mics in the car, handing them out to the contributors and the people who do this, seeing what would happen, what would work. And since then, we've put out, I think, about an average of 11 or 12 podcasts a week. And now that's across the platform, but nonetheless, the echo chamber has been the bulk of that. And it doesn't happen unless people actually support it. I've taken a lot of criticism saying, why are they always in crisis mode? I'll tell you why we're in crisis mode. Because we chose to try and expand. We chose to try and grow. We tried to do the things that we said we'd do. We'd honor the commitments that we made to people, and we tried to work with a producer, work with other things and get things done. And it doesn't actually make any financial sense. It was put to us earlier, Martin. If you reduce the hours down, we'd been better off on JobBridge.
I would have, certainly. There's no doubt about that.
And it cracks me up, but it's true. And it's galling, but it's true. If you value the Tortoise Shack, please put something back into it. It's a fancy cup of coffee once a month. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. That's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. You'll find it's well worth it, because actually you've missed out. If you haven't been listening, you missed Dara O'Brien's conversation with us. You missed Ono Brins. You missed Ivana Bacic's. I mean, you've missed loads of stuff. It's staying behind the paywall. And the simple reason it has to stay behind the paywall, Martin, you know this, is that if we don't...
Because we have patrons, and we like to honor the patrons as well with the stuff that we do. So there's some of the stuff that has to stay behind the paywall. Otherwise, what's the point in being a patron? That's the point of it. Look, to become on board with this, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's easy done. You'll have it done in 2 minutes. And then you're contributing to... Well, it's not a family operation. It certainly feels like one. Thanks.
Enjoy your podcast.
So a small number of people with a vaccinated population, which is what we have now, a small number of people will die. A somewhat larger number will become seriously unwell. And it looks like around 10%, give or take, will have long-term health effects. And that's just the virus. We've had this process. We do something similar with climate change. We kind of try and bargain with climate change. We're trying to bargain with the virus. Well, viruses are not the kind of thing you can negotiate with. Negotiating the virus is like negotiating with forest fire. Nobody sits down and has a meaningful discussion with a forest fire. You put it out. Nobody can sit down and have a meaningful discussion with a virus. You control it, or by and large, you get it. This virus is very infectious, spreads easily. There are many nasty viruses out there which don't make it to our climate, because whatever it is that carries them doesn't survive here. But we had malaria in Britain in the Victorian period. We had malaria in Cork in the 1700s. There's no magic that says these things can't come back. And there's an argument that says climate change might drive them. And we can't negotiate with them. You can't have a reasoned argument with a mosquito. You control it. You do what you need to do to protect your population from it. And we haven't done that. So we haven't put the effort into managing outbreaks. And managing outbreaks is something, it's something public health has been doing for, I don't know, 700 or 800 years. I mean, ever since the first port official looked at the first sailor coming off a gangplank looking sick and said, you get back on that ship and no one get off that ship till you're all either dead or better. Ever since then, we've controlled outbreaks in pretty much the same way. We stop the spread. We find the sick people. We look after the sick people. And we stop the spread of whatever it is they've got. Runs throughout the population, because we don't want the chance of it running through our population.
Can I big picture this a little, Anthony? Mm. There's 5 billion people who have no access to a vaccine on the planet. That's a huge amount. So no matter what work we do in this country, we are an island, but we're not isolated. Mm. No matter what we do, if we focus on Delta, we should really be focusing on Gamma. That's the next one that's coming along, or the one after that, or the one after that. And until the entire planet is vaccinated, we are in this cycle. Is that not correct?
It is pretty much. If you look at polio, I live in Skerries, North County Dublin, and there was a huge outbreak of polio here in 1955. And I remember it because my mother was on holidays here in 1955. One of her closest friends who lived next door got polio and was severely affected. She was able to walk with some difficulty for the rest of her life. She didn't need to be ventilated. So she could have done much worse. But we don't tolerate that. You know, we don't say, well, you know, polio, let it zip through the population. And because most people who get polio are small children, they have a bit of diarrhea, and then they get better. Symptoms of polio in small children are decidedly unusual. It's polio in older people, in adolescents and adults, that typically causes paralysis. But we don't put up with it. We have protection against polio. We control, if there were a polio outbreak, we would descend in it and control it. If there's a measles outbreak, we descend in it and control it. And it's, you know, we don't control the whole planet, but there's our peers across the world do the same thing. So we've driven polio back, and it's taken a long time. But polio may be extinct in Africa. It's still present in Afghanistan, where you can imagine there's some very specific problems as the Taliban comes back, as the fighting breaks out again. And it's still present in parts of Pakistan. But again, that's being controlled. So it takes time, but we can and we do push back against viruses. We don't have to sit around and wait for them to spread through our populations. That's a ridiculous idea.
Anthony, can I ask a question? We've touched on it already about, you know, you said how very few children are impacted by COVID. Like they don't generally end up being hospitalized. Mm. I've heard a lot of talk about now that we'll start vaccinating, you know, under 16s, then down to the under 12s, and we'll work in those cohorts as the data improves, as we get the analysis. Is that in your mind? Like, I saw a phrase, and again, there are no plans currently to close schools in September. Was a headline. It's a worrying thing when you're reporting a negative like that. You know, it's like there's no plan. I've no plans for my house to burn down either. But but these things happen. So what do you make in terms of the teenage cohorts and the idea of maybe, you know, let's have a vaccinations policy for them at this stage?
I think the evidence is pretty clear that vaccination is beneficial to teenagers. We know there are rare side effects from the vaccines. We also know those same side effects occur, but occur more frequently with wild-type COVID. So in that sense, it's not unlike measles vaccination. Measles vaccination causes severe side effects very rarely. Wild-type measles, which every child will get if you haven't got vaccination up and running, because measles is incredibly infectious. Wild-type measles causes a lot more complications. So we make the decision to vaccinate children, and we have systems in place to monitor vaccine side effects. We know about the side effects of COVID vaccine because our systems for monitoring the side effects work. And our data is from, I think the US has given about 10 million doses of vaccine to people under the age of 20. And inevitably, we're going to be moving into vaccinating primary school age children. And we do this already. We vaccinate children against rubella. For a child, rubella is a trivial illness. German measles, they're sick for a day or two. They have a bit of a rash, very, very seldom more than that. But if you happen to be pregnant and you're exposed to German measles, there's a very high chance that your baby will be affected in a whole variety of different ways, depending on exactly when you get infected. So we vaccinate children against German measles to protect unborn babies. That's why we do it. We vaccinate one-year-olds against measles mainly to protect smaller babies, because we can't protect smaller babies against measles. But if they get it, it tends to be a pretty devastating illness. It's not very nice in older children either. When we had measles outbreaks, we typically had 2 or 3 deaths from measles every year. And we had 20, 30 children with measles pneumonia on ventilators during each outbreak. And none of these are nice things. So we've now vaccinated against measles, and measles doesn't circulate in Ireland anymore. We still get cases. They're all imported.
Anthony, can I ask, indoor dining opens today. There are rules and regulations and meters and all of that, but there's also concern that ventilation is not the key factor, which it should be.
Can I correct you on one thing? There's not rules and regulations, there's guidelines. It's very important to say this. They publish them as guidelines. And when you publish as guidelines, it's a lot different than giving rules. So anyway, go ahead.
Do you think that it's a good idea at the present moment in time, Anthony?
No. My concern is that the indoor dining will open up and two things will happen. One is that people won't want to do it. And several people from the restaurant trade have been on the radio saying, well, we've looked into this and we're not opening. Or we've looked into this and we're keeping our outdoor venues going. I spoke to someone in the marquee business who rents marquees to pubs, among other places. And their comment was many of their customers have said, well, you know, can we hang on to the marquee for a while yet till we see what's going to happen? I would be worried that indoor hospitality might need to be closed again. You know, I'm hoping it won't happen, obviously, because it would be devastating for everybody. But if there's a major spike in cases, either people might stop going to eat indoors, in which case they might as well close, or the government might turn around, as the Taoiseach has said, and put on the brakes again. The problem is we're not going to know for several weeks what the effect is. But I was struck by a headline in one of the papers this morning. The Northern Ireland Executive is meeting in Stormont today with two items on the agenda. One is coping with the sharp increase in the number of COVID cases, because they've now got the highest rate in Britain and one of the highest rates in the world. And the other is reducing restrictions on social activity. And to have these two conversations at the same time in the same people says there's some serious disconnect in people's minds about what's going on. And it comes back to this idea of negotiating with the virus. You know, we'll be good. We'll wear our masks some of the time. Just leave us alone.
Give us a meaningful Christmas.
We've heard that one before, I think.
I think it's, there's, okay, I'm gonna I was going to say play devil's advocate, but I'm not. I'm just going to outline some of the other concerns that we've had. Hotels have had indoor dining for the duration of a lot of this period recently, whereby they've had restaurants open. We have, you know, we had Sean Drogan on. Vintage Kitchen reopens today. All the best of luck to you, Sean. Genuinely mean it. As I hope your restaurant thrives and goes. And I know he spent thousands, Martin, on an air filtration system to try and keep the ventilation going. And that goes beyond COVID. I mean, you know, this is the reality of this situation. But there was also a phrase used by the Taoiseach recently where he said the level of deaths per thousand cases per, and he broke it down relative Delta relative to the previous wave, and he said it was manageable. I got a bit of a chill, Anthony. I think it's a bit unusual to refer to deaths, and I'm going to go and finish my point by saying Jacinda Ardern, who we all talk about as having managed this well. She just didn't think there was any level of death that was acceptable. And we're talking about manageable. It is a different mindset.
It's a different perspective and it's a different mindset. And the government has been, I think, quite blunt about it. They have said, yeah, there is an acceptable number of deaths. I guess you might ask, you know, who's expected to die and to what cause and what purpose? The likelihood is that most of the people who die will be people who are at high risk and who have been vaccinated. That seems the most likely outcome, because you know, if your risk of dying from this virus was 10% before you got vaccinated, after you get vaccinated, your risk's about 1%, which is still very high. It's still 10 times your risk of dying from flu. So that's kind of discouraging for people in the high-risk groups.
It is discouraging. And I don't know, we don't stop trying to resolve the number of deaths on the road every year. Mm-hmm. We constantly work towards zero, and that is the policies, to work towards zero and to make the changes along the way you need to do to achieve that. Now, nobody's saying it's a quick process, but you have to take the steps to go there. We've never turned around and said, well, you know, we're happy with 350 people a year dying on the road. We've done enough. We never do that. So why is the mindset different with this?
I think there's a couple of different pieces that come together. One is that wealthy societies like ours don't take infectious disease seriously. It's not been a challenge for us. Now, that's a misunderstanding. We spend hundreds of millions every year on antibiotic-resistant infections, for example. But it is nonetheless what people think, that infectious diseases are a problem of our grandparents' generation. And, you know, they're not. The second is that it's hard to persuade people that you actually need to come in and act fast. Mike Ryan said this right at the beginning of this pandemic. He said it, I think, the 1st or 2nd of March last year. And he said it based on 25 years experience dealing with major outbreaks of disease all over the world, that you act fast. You go in hard. You go in, I don't think he said this, but you go in with your boots swinging. And you will get things wrong. I mean, initially, we thought COVID behaved like flu. In fact, it doesn't. And we did some of the stuff that we planned for flu, and some of that was really important and some of it was irrelevant. But we didn't know that at the time, but we did act. But what we didn't do was wheel out the resources. So countries that brought COVID cases right down and kept them down, the one thing they all did that we did not do was they put a lot of bodies, part-time temporary bodies, into regional public health to do the who's sick, where did they get sick, who have they met up with, and do they need help to isolate? And they did that. South Korea hired about several thousand people to do that across their country. We brought on a bunch of people who were seconded from other pieces in HSE, and we took them all off again in the summer of 2020, and case numbers dutifully began to rise again. And we'd effectively eliminated COVID from our population at that point, but we stopped. We took our foot off the brakes, and that brought us to last October, another lockdown, meaningful Christmas, huge spike, another lockdown. We've argued from the beginning of this that lockdowns are a terrible way to control infection in communities. What lockdowns do is they buy you time. You know, their case numbers are doubling every 3 days. Close everything and then sit down, work out why, and work out what you need to do and mobilize the resources to keep the case numbers down so that you can open up everything. And you look at the time course in, even in Australia, which The Australians didn't vaccinate. That was their big mistake. But even in Australia, which now has three large outbreaks of COVID, businesses have done okay. Gross domestic product has risen. Businesses have coped with it. Here, businesses have been steamrolled by repeated uncertain lockdowns. And that was a policy choice made by our government.
On the Australia piece, so obviously we know we spoke to consultant Niall Conroy, and it's important we point out consultant Niall Conroy, because the equivalent in Ireland is doctor. We didn't treat public health seriously enough, whereby our best and our brightest are actually managing a pandemic in other parts of the world. And Niall has experience in Sierra Leone of managing pandemics and managing and outbreaks. But it's important to point out, obviously, relative to size of population, they're rubbing their hands with glee at a little bit of a misery that they've had, where they've been open for a year, more or less, and now they're experiencing lockdowns in some capacity. But their mortality rate is a fraction of ours, a tiny fraction of ours. And I think that's really important that people get their heads around it. You're right when you say they're at the bottom towards vaccinations, but that's because they didn't opt in as many options as we did. We went and bought vaccines from Romania, Anthony. That's what we've done. I put it to you though. If again, I was on the podcast. I don't know if you listened to it. Dr. Mike Ryan was on with Rory and Gabrielle Collar, and it was brilliant. Yeah. But he spoke about the fact that, oh, what's the problem of putting all these people in dense housing with crappy sanitation close to an airport that can get you anywhere in the world in a couple of hours, and we're eating into vegetation and natural habitats and forcing people into contact with humans into contact with other species. Mm. This is the toxic mix that we've delivered to society. And you touched on it, Anthony, at the beginning of this podcast. Climate change seems to have changed everything. I mean, we look at the breakdown that's happening in the last few weeks, floods in Germany, people losing their lives. I mean, we look outside our windows and we think everything's great, but it's not natural for Ireland to have 28, 30 degrees. It's just not what we do. And if we don't act quickly in the face of a global pandemic, what chance have we got when these things become more pronounced? Because with climate breakdown, people are on the move.
I suppose the very short answer to that is that planetary ecosystems are self-regulating systems, and there is absolutely no guarantee that the self-regulated planetary ecosystem includes humans. COVID is not going to bring down our technological civilization. Climate change could easily bring down our technological civilization. I gave a talk to some people in Swords a few years ago, and I said, there is every prospect that your grandchildren will be writing the history of this period with quill pens, oak gall ink, on animal hides, assuming they can remember how to tan leather. What are you going to do about it? And there is every prospect of that. Our civilization is much more fragile than people appreciate. We have great strengths, great resilience, but at the same time, we are doing insane stuff. People complain loudly when we dare to subsidize solar power or wind farms, that we're interfering with the market. But spending $3 trillion a year on subsidies for fossil fuels, which is what we currently do, is regarded as business as usual. Some oil company is currently suing the Italian government, and judgment is expected in the next few days at an investor state dispute settlement tribunal. And if you think the Doyle Erin looks male, stale and pale, take a look at the process. Mind you, look at this panel, but take a look at the process by which the arbitrators in those panels are selected. It's extraordinary.
Wait till we introduce CETA, which actually signs us up to those investor dispute mechanisms?
Well, we've actually already signed up to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So don't card yourselves about that. So, but
I just want to, for listeners' benefits, thank you, Bertie Ahern, for signing us up to the Energy Charter without any dispute back in, I think it was 1994, thereabouts. Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Ahern.
That's what Italy's being sued under, is the Energy Charter. And they're being sued because they don't want somebody to develop fossil fuel reserves. We have an Irish oil company, which should remain nameless, which is endeavouring to secure funding to explore prospects in the Irish Sea, where they have an exploration license. But the truth is, we can't afford to allow those reserves, if they exist, we don't know if they exist or not, to be used. We can't afford to burn the reserves we know about, never mind go looking for reserves we don't know about. We've seen what probably a 1 degree centigrade change in climate does. And it's not good. It's not good at all. I'm watching the United States, where essentially the whole Western United States is on fire. The heat dome that was sitting over the Western United States is now running over the whole United States, except a bit of the East Coast. You know, move to Vermont would be my advice.
Can I ask, that's
not natural.
Can I ask, back on COVID, can I ask you a question, Anthony? Because there seems to be a sense we're almost there. And that seems to be the sense, or the narrative we're getting. In your professional opinion, are we at the beginning? Are we at the end? Are we at the beginning of the end, or at the end of the beginning?
We here in the countries that have loads of vaccine are at the beginning of the end, unless a new variant emerges, in which case all bets are off. Many countries in the world are in dire straits. The Tunisian government, for example, may fall because of COVID, because they don't have vaccines. It would be an incredibly intelligent investment by the European Union in its own security to vaccinate everyone in Tunisia, or in fact, to vaccinate everyone in all of North Africa. Be a hugely beneficial investment in our own security to do that. The OECD have calculated the payback from vaccinating the planet. It is tens of billions a year. And what stands in the way of that is the property rights for a very small number of corporations, which have taken research that was overwhelmingly publicly funded and used it. Now, I'm not arguing that the corporations have not brought skill to the game. Making vaccines at scale is really, really hard. But we need a crash program to make those vaccines at scale globally. And we're not getting it. We need the governments to put up probably something like 30 or 40 billion to build vaccine production plants, which can be used to produce future vaccines as well. They're not tied to one particular vaccine, but they need to be everywhere.
And we've advocated on this podcast for a people's vaccine, for the TRIPS waiver, for things. Mm. Ireland has kind of disgracefully voted or decided to abstain from the argument and kept itself out of it, which is really, and considering we're now, you know, we're going to have a plant on the island of Ireland that will manufacture the Pfizer vaccine. I mean, it's even, it doesn't add up. And it goes back to my point of how do we deal with more catastrophic change that's coming. Mm. Can I ask a last thing, going back to the overall this summer? There are parts of me that feel we will emerge from this, want to be optimistic, we will get vaccines. And this is purely greedy thinking from an Irish perspective, that we will emerge from this and we won't be facing October as bleak and as bad as it was. But am I fooling myself, or are there other variants, that because this, we've had several variants already. And the virus wants to survive. Ultimately, that's what it does. It replicates, it changes, and it adapts. Am I wrong in thinking that I think, you know, we won't be going into another lockdown?
I hope you're not. But the truth is, we don't know. If you think of the viruses as being like different breeds of dogs, there's a very wide range of breeds of dogs. You know, ranging from the soft, fluffy balls of fur that would kind of lick you to death to, you know, more serious working dogs to some quite aggressive territorial dogs, which can be quite dangerous if you don't know how to handle them or you don't train them properly. We don't know for this virus what the range is. We don't know if they go from the cute and fluffy up to the kind of death on four legs end, or if they just go from the cute and fluffy to the kind of more serious working dog, which would be your Delta variant. We don't really want to find out. We know the Lambda variant and the Beta variant are circulating in England right now. Both of them seem to be outcompeted by the Delta variant, which is very transmissible. We don't have a variant yet that is highly vaccine resistant and highly transmissible and more severe. Whether we can have such a variant or not, I have no idea. And I'm afraid, I think nobody else knows either. But I do know that we don't want to find out.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, Anthony. I think the best advice has been all along, proceed with caution.
Yeah.
And I think that is the best advice. Thank you very much for coming on and having this discussion, Anthony. As always, you are our favorite Gaeler, and we do love having you on this show. And thank you for coming on.
Listen, folks, just to say, we will be, there's more podcasts coming this way, but we're trying to work one at the moment on neurodivergent thought, and I have to, we're lining up a lot of guests. So if you're a patron, drop me a message if you can recommend a few guests as well, because I want to do it properly. It's something that, you know, I don't want to do it half-assed, or as we call it around here, a Martin on it. please send me a message. Professor Anthony Staines, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us again. And we will be back in your feed shortly, guys. We said we were taking some time off, Martin. I think we're still, like, we're just
God, we don't even know what time off is. We're workaholics, Tony. We just never stop.
No, suckers
for punishment.
I got 3 hours off.
I don't
off.
Know.
I got 3 hours off on Sunday. So that was a start. Talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin. Martin and Tony. Speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.